Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. Thanks very much for coming. And welcome to this forum panel discussion on the topic of evolution and moral progress. My name is Jonathan Birch. I'm an assistant professor of philosophy here at the LSE, and I'm going to be chairing tonight's discussion. I have to start with two announcements of forthcoming events that have unfortunately had to be cancelled. The first one is the Comp Lecture, The Problem of the Political, that was to be delivered by Niko Kolodny. And the other is a panel discussion on the theme of policing by ear. Unfortunately, both have had to be cancelled because of speakers from the US who have not been able to fly over due to health reasons. But this event is going ahead and should be very interesting. The background to this event is that really from the moment The Origin of Species was published, it's been clear that it had profound implications for who we are and for the very most fundamental aspects of our nature, including our moral nature. And Darwin himself in The Descent of Man provided a speculative evolutionary history of human morality. Now, 150 years later, we have a number of much more well-developed, sophisticated accounts of the evolution of human morality. It's still an area, though, in which there's a great deal of controversy and disagreement. But what does seem clear is that it seems increasingly hard to deny that at least some of our moral beliefs do have a deep evolutionary history and have been shaped by evolutionary processes like natural selection. And the aim of this panel discussion tonight is to think about the philosophical consequences of the evolution of morality. What does the evolution of morality mean for the objectivity of ethics? What does it mean for the possibility of moral progress? Does the evolution of morality show that morality is just a kind of illusion, just an adaptation to the demands of Stone Age life that was never tracking timeless moral truths to begin with and that may have outlived its usefulness? Are we locked into tribal ways of thinking that belong in the Stone Age? Or is a more inclusive sort of morality possible? Our panel is going to be considering these and related questions. And it's a pleasure tonight to be able to introduce panelists who in various different ways are really at the cutting edge of these philosophical debates. Starting on my left, we have Professor Alan Buchanan, a professor of philosophy at Duke University and also a professor of the philosophy of international law at King's College London. Really a world-renowned expert on bioethics and on the philosophy of international law. Then we have Catherine Wilson, a professor of philosophy at York University and also at the City University of New York, an expert on the nature of morality. She's also written widely on early modern philosophy and on the relationship between philosophy and the sciences. And then we have Professor Jason Alexander from here at the LSE, a philosopher of social science who's literally written the book on the evolution of morality in 2007. Now, to give you a sense of the format for tonight's event, the discussion will be structured around four key questions. Is morality an evolved adaptation? Does the evolutionary history of morality undermine the idea that morality is objective? If morality is an evolved adaptation, does this limit the potential for moral progress? And fourthly, if moral progress is indeed at least possible, how can it be achieved in practice? In each case, I'll ask one of our panelists to provide a few brief introductory remarks on that question. Then we'll have a discussion among the panelists for a few minutes, and then we'll open up the discussion to questions from the audience. We'll have a batch of questions, and then we'll move on to the next topic. So a lot to get through, so let's get started straight away. First key question: is morality an evolved adaptation? And to introduce us to that question, I'd like to ask Jason Alexander to say a few words.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan. So to begin with, what I would like to note is that in asking the question, is morality an evolved adaptation, that there's a danger in thinking about what it means to speak of an evolved adaptation and think of morality as if it were just a single trait. For example, we can talk about resistance to malaria as an evolved adaptation, or the ability to metabolize milk or alcohol. The point is, morality as a social practice is much more complex than any of those particular individual traits. And so when we talk about, or when we ask the question, is morality an evolved adaptation, we need to realize that the social practice of morality is complex and consists of many different facets, all of which are potential candidates for being given an evolutionary explanation. And what I would like to do is just talk through three of those before moving on to the question about what exactly do we mean when we talk about evolution, and again, what is the sense of adaptation that we might be concerned with. First point, when we think about morality as a social practice, one thing that involves are the moral sentiments. These are moral emotions such as sympathy, empathy, pity, compassion, and so on. These emotions certainly play an incredibly vital role in our moral lives and in terms of motivating moral action. But at the same time, it's important to realize that these moral emotions, sympathy, compassion, pity, pride, and so on, may or may not always be addressed at a particular target which is of moral concern. Right? We can feel pity for someone for various moral reasons. We might feel shame for reasons that have to do with various actions that we have performed in the past that we are being criticized from or for. But at the same time, we might feel pity or shame for things that also fall outside the remit of areas of particular moral concern. So thinking exactly about the scope of the moral sentiments, the moral emotions, and how they have evolved is itself a complex question. Second, there are various capacities which also play an important role in our moral life. The ability to perform moral evaluations, to deliberate about what we ought to do, and the ability to form moral judgments. These capacities allow us to do certain things, but again, the ability to deliberate, the ability to make evaluations and to judge are not themselves solely restricted to just the area of morality. Thirdly, when we talk about morality, that we have to pay attention to the things that we believe. What we believe we should do in a particular case, what general principles we believe, like thou shalt not kill. The reason I call attention to these is that they involve three very different things. One is the capacity to feel certain emotions, or the ability to feel just outright. The second is the capacity to do certain things, to evaluate, to judge, to deliberate. And the third is the capacity to believe. Now, the point is this. When we talk about is morality an evolved adaptation, which of those three aspects, if any, are we trying to give an evolutionary account for? This matters because it seems quite plausible that our moral emotions, our moral sentiments like empathy and sympathy, can be given an evolutionary history. There's good experimental evidence to suggest that proto-moral emotions, such as sympathy or empathy, have ancestors amongst the social primates. In terms of the capacity to deliberate and evaluate, it seems that those too can be given or might admit an evolutionary explanation. But if you think about the specific content of our moral beliefs, those seem to be less amenable to evolutionary explanations from a biological point of view. So to move on to this, the next thing I wanted to say about evolution, we need to realize that evolution can be understood in terms of biological evolution or cultural evolution. Both of these have important roles to play in talking about the evolution of morality, but they can do so in a complex, interdependent way. There can be co-evolutionary effects between biological evolution and cultural evolution, such that each influences the other. For example, we have the capacity to have beliefs that guide our actions. The particular content of those beliefs is probably influenced by changes in society and our own particular learning history over time. So if we think about morality as a phenomenon to explain evolutionarily, we can't solely concentrate on just biology or cultural evolution. Lastly, and then I'll stop, when we think about adaptation, are we talking about what is advantageous at the level of individuals or groups? Because those two forces can actually pull in very different directions. So to answer the question, is morality an evolved adaptation? I would say the answer is probably in some respects. The particular details are going to be, it depends very greatly on the specific aspects of morality of which you're talking about.
Thanks very much, Jason. Let's now have discussion on those comments from the panel. Catherine?
Oh, so you referred, Jason, mainly to the pro-social emotions of sympathy and altruism, which you've written a great deal about. What about the antisocial emotions? How do you see those as fitting into moral theory and question of progress?
I think the antisocial emotions are play an incredibly important role as well in understanding morality. But I want to put it the following way. So if you think that morality has an important role to play in the well-functioning of society, in terms of making societies operate smoothly in the sense that people are able to negotiate their social life in a way that minimizes conflict and minimizes competition between individuals, then antisocial emotions, such as envy and so on, play an important role in understanding moral behavior, but in a way that tells us what kinds of behaviors to avoid. If I can just say something very quickly on this, I think it's interesting to note that if you look at the Ten Commandments, and here I'm stealing a line shamelessly from P.J. O'Rourke in one of his books about economics. If you look at the Ten Commandments, the first nine contain very important general principles like thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not make graven images or bear false witness. By the time you get to the Tenth Commandment, one translation says things, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's manservant or oxen or possessions and so on. And you think there seems to be a great descent in terms of the nobility from thou shalt not kill to don't envy your buddy's cow, right? And so you think, well, what's going on in that? And it seems like warning against envy and the kind of negative consequences that can bring has an important role culturally in eliminating behaviors as well as encouraging other behaviors.
I would just like to say one thing about what it means to say something's an adaptation. I think he began with a very good point that we usually think of traits as being adaptations, and morality is not a trait, it's a complex social phenomenon. But also, it's important to realize that the term adaptation is strictly backward-looking. To say that something is an adaptation is to say that at some point in the past, having that trait was beneficial from the standpoint of inclusive fitness, reproductive fitness. It says nothing whatsoever about the function of the trait at present. It may be that something that's an adaptation used to be valuable, and perhaps it came about because at some earlier point in the lineage of the organism in question, it was conducive to reproductive fitness, but now it may be not beneficial, it may be neutral, or it may be deleterious. So when we talk about something being an adaptation, that doesn't tell us anything at all about the role that it's playing now. And a second point, which I think we'll see becomes important later, to say that something's an adaptation, this backward-looking statement about it, statement about something in the past being valuable from the standpoint of reproductive fitness, also doesn't tell us anything about the possibilities of how that has developed over time in ways that may not be related to reproductive fitness. So it might turn out that a good deal of morality, at least some of our basic moral responses, moral sentiments, moral capacities, may be adaptations in the sense that they were selected for in some earlier environment, and in that environment played some beneficial role for individuals and groups. But it might be that now there have been changes. So to say that, to tell an evolutionary story about the origins of morality may not tell us everything we need to know about what morality is like now.
So if I can just follow up on that. I think the point about adaptations being backward-looking and the connection to fitness is very important to keep in mind, because if you think about the evolutionary origins of morality, whatever selection effects existed early on presumably had to be the case that they were fitness enhancing in the sense of expected number of offspring. But certainly once you move into what we might consider the relatively contemporary era, we get a decoupling between what is considered morally valuable and fitness enhancing from the point of view of expected number of offspring. And so what we need to think about in, as I said, this kind of co-evolutionary interaction between biological and cultural evolution is that at some point, what ends up doing the selection effects for the evolution of our morality becomes detached from reproductive fitness to other social measures of fitness. And so that's an interesting complicating factor to this attempt to give such an account.
Thanks. Okay. I would now like to invite contributions, questions from the audience on this topic. What I'd like to do is ideally take around two or three questions. There would usually be a roving microphone, and there is. Fantastic. So please wait for the microphone to come to you. We need to get your voice on there for the recording. Please also keep your questions short and to the point so that we have time to get in as many as possible. Please put your hands up if you would like to ask a question on this topic of the evolution of morality. The front here.
I tend to think of being good as doing something in the interest of the group. And when I'm looking after my own interests, that's selfish, and I think of that as not moral. Don't know if that's right, but that's the way I think of it. My question is, so it seems to me that morals that evolve are always going to be at a group level rather than an individual level. Is that right?
Thanks. Yes, so a question about whether if morality is an adaptation, it's always this group level adaptation. Jason, would you like to address that?
So I would like to say that certainly many aspects of morality do have this pro-social, other-directed aspect to it. But one thing to keep in mind, which is very important, is that many philosophers have certain moral intuitions in which group-level benefits are neither here nor there at all. And one perhaps very well-known example of this would be Immanuel Kant, who said that you cannot consider the consequences of what it is that you're doing as a motivation for why you act. What you're supposed to do is the right thing, irrespective of the consequences. And the canonical kind of phrase is, you should do the right thing, even if though the world may end as a result. And so this is an interesting case where one's beliefs about what is required, what is the right thing to do, are entirely irrelevant from the point of view of maximizing group benefit. Now, I think an interesting question is, how did that attitude come about? Many people are Kantians. Many people think that consequences are irrelevant for assessing the moral worth or rightness of an action. But if what matters is the group level effect, the kind of fitness consequences, how is it that we could actually have selection shaping in a population this belief which seems to completely disregard any of those consequences? I think that's a very interesting question. I think it's very hard to give to present an answer to that.
And another question from the middle here. And then immediately after that, we'll go a couple of rows back. Sorry for the delay as the microphone gets to you.
Hi. Surely that if evolution isn't, if morality isn't an evolutionary process, that means you wouldn't believe in evolution, surely, because we are all organic, and therefore everything we experience and do is a form of evolution. And I think that having people that have bad morality is a very important process in the whole evolution process. Sorry, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, and then a further question from two rows back.
I just want to say, I know that my question was spiritually, if we as a people have evolved from, as we say, primates, not having any spiritual sense with each other. If we've evolved to having spiritual sense with each other, does that categorize into the evolutionary stages? Did we evolve spiritually? And if so, have we came together and that's probably made us moral with each other if we know how to judge each other? Is that spiritually or is that from evolution? And also I wanted to say, is it bad for us if someone isn't moral? Is it bad for us as a society to keep them into the society? As evolution says only, or Darwin's theory says, only the fittest shall survive. So if unmoral actions are being caused by these individuals, is it bad for us as a society to keep them within the society? Or that was my question.
Thanks. Yes, so a number of related issues raised there. I mean, this question about whether we're compelled, if we accept evolution, to accept that morality has evolved. An issue about whether the evolution of morality must also be the evolution of spirituality of some sort. And then also an interesting point at the end there about whether this response that seems to have a deep history in the human lineage of ostracizing people who don't conform to moral norms is still an appropriate response to people who fail to behave morally. Jason, would you like to start on these questions?
Well, yeah, just a couple of observations. One is that if you think of morality as an evolutionary process, there's little reason to think that evolution will only select for what we might consider to be the morally advantageous or morally correct behavior. We know statistically that that certain tendencies for mental antisocial behavior, right? Certain kinds of sociopathic tendencies tend to hover around 1% of the population, right? Fairly stably, and that's something which doesn't seem to be selected against from an evolutionary point of view. I mean, there's presumably a kind of fitness advantageous reason why that low level of social deviance persists. So it's not the case that evolution is going to solely select for virtuous behavior. In terms of the point of view about the spirituality of evolution, I think that touches upon a very interesting question about what motivates people to act morally. And so if you think about moral behavior, one of the things that's quite difficult to explain is what is it that causes people to do what they ought to do in cases where it actually violates their own particular material interests at a moment in time. So if you think about, say, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not lie, and so on, why is it that people would actually be motivated to obey those principles when it actually goes against, things that would benefit themselves personally? So I think the point about spirituality can be perhaps brought into bear here, as that facet of how people think of themselves, how they conceive of themselves, and how they understand their position in the world, setting aside questions about the actual metaphysics of whether we do or do not have souls or spirits, thinking of ourselves in that way can be a very useful motivator for engaging in that kind of behavior that we think of as moral, even though it goes against our own self-interest in some cases.
Uh-huh. Yeah, just to sort of to put up a flag here, this question about spirituality, there's a fairly large literature on trying to figure out whether there's an evolutionary story to be told about religion or about religiosity. Religion's a little like morality. It's a very complex thing. But suppose there were something, with great simplification, we could call religiosity. The question is, well, is there an evolutionary story that would explain why human beings, or at least many human beings, come to have that? And one of the suggestions that's been made, as he just suggested, is that if people have a certain conception of religion, this can work as a kind of enforcer that leads them to behave according to norms that may benefit the group rather than as individuals, because it's as if there is a kind of unseen enforcer looking over their shoulder who will punish them in the afterlife, if not in the present life. Now, there are other people who think that that's not the appropriate evolutionary account of religion or some aspects of religion. They think that religion or religiosity may be a kind of byproduct of some other adaptations that evolved through natural selection. So I think that's a topic, fortunately, for another forum. It's a huge topic.
Catherine?
Yes, I thought that's a great point. In fact, I was hoping we could talk a bit about religiosity and the way in which people think of the objectivity of morality, inevitably in theological terms, as a command that you must obey, whether it goes against your self-interest or not.
Great. I mean, I think that leads us very nicely into our second key question, in fact. I mean, we've already seen the picture getting quite complicated, right? That this question, is morality an evolved adaptation? It's more complicated than you might initially think. There's the question of, well, what evolves? Is it things we feel? Is it things we do? Is it things we believe? There's the question of what kind of evolution? Is it biological or cultural evolution? And then there's the question of, well, what kind of adaptation? Is it an adaptation of us as individuals or an adaptation of human groups? And I'd now like to further complicate the picture by bringing in this notion of objectivity. Does the evolution of morality, the idea that morality has an evolutionary history, does it undermine the objectivity of ethics? And to introduce us to that topic, Catherine Wilson.
Okay, thanks. Well, I suppose there are really two main reasons why you might think that evolutionary theory did undermine the objectivity of ethics. And one is, if you accepted a Ten Commandments account, then you converted to Darwinism, you might feel, well, now I've lost the whole objective basis of ethics. I have to start over. But the other reason that people are kind of made uneasy by evolutionary accounts of morality is there's a very grim history of, ever since the origin of the species appeared, using arguments about natural selection to argue for morally repellent conclusions. One person who did this was Ernst Haeckel, the end of the 19th century. He held imperialistic, racist views, and he argued that we just have to help nature along in eliminating the less developed, stupider, uglier, less competent races. Nature is trying to do that, and we have to get behind her. In more recent times, some people have written lots of books about males and females, and they tell you things like men are naturally promiscuous, women are naturally monogamous, and evolution has made them that way, and then they go on and give you some science about that. Those books are out of date. Do not believe them. Read more recent discussions of childbearing and male and female behavior and competencies. It's all on a spectrum and on overlapping spectrums. People are enormously different. Human nature is a range of behaviors, ambivalences, conflicts, impulses to be helpful, impulses to take advantage, and that's why we have morality, as Jason was saying. So I ask you to think a little bit about objectivity and what we even mean by objectivity. So one form of objectivity is just common sense. We all see that the traffic light is red. It's an objective fact that the traffic light is red, or that it was red when the pedestrian walked into the street and got hit. So objective facts like that have legal consequences, social consequences. You can go to jail because of a fact like that. And those facts exist in part because we all have pretty much the same perceptual apparatus, or can at least pretty much, even though there are people who don't have good color vision, agree that the light was red. Moral perception, even though some philosophers have tried to show that there is moral perception that is just like that, you just see the wickedness of some action, or you see the unacceptability of some social institution, and despite the fact that people disagree across societies, but also within societies, they claim, well, if you are properly brought up, properly educated, you will have good moral perception. And that's what education tries to do. Well, that's one way to think about morality as like perception, but I don't think it's really a very good way because of this problem of divergence and because of the historical process of sweeping change that really makes this immediate perception account pretty irrelevant. I think it's more appropriate to think of moral objectivity as a bit, in some ways, like theoretical discovery in the sciences. Not entirely, because the test of whether you have something objective to take hold of in, say, chemistry is what you can do with it. If you know that water is H2O, even though water and hydrogen peroxide look pretty much the same, you know that you can bleach your hair with hydrogen peroxide but not with water, and that you shouldn't drink hydrogen peroxide to quench your thirst. So you're always testing against reality, and that confirms your theory. You accept it because it's empirically adequate. Now, in some ways, morality seems to work like that. Our institutions are constantly being tested against people's grievances and complaints, and that's a very important form of social testing, but it takes a long time. And I think if we want to think about moral progress, that's really one venue through which it comes. People express their grievances, and eventually we end up taking account of them. So maybe the best way to understand objectivity, which will feed into the next talk, is the objective system of morality, which wouldn't have to be the same for everybody, no matter where they're living, how old they are, what their condition of life is. But the objective system would be the system that was the endpoint of progressive thinking. And progress is understood as, I suppose, progress towards what is more objective. So now the question is, does something about our evolutionary heritage make progress difficult or impossible, if we associate objectivity with progress? And there, well, we have to be a little careful of overgeneralizing, because just the fact that our cognitive and emotional structure was shaped by evolution doesn't seem to prevent us from discovering things in mathematics, natural science, space, things like that. There's nothing wrong with our cognitive apparatus as such. But since we have this dismal history, we have to wonder whether there's something about our cognitive emotional apparatus that at least has made it somewhat difficult to experience moral progress as rapidly as we would like. There's no question, I think, that we have experienced it. If you just look at the abolition of some forms of slavery, I know we have others, textile industry in the Far East, the end to the persecution of homosexuals, the apologies for the things that happened, and truth and reconciliation commissions in South Africa. There has been progress. I don't think we need to argue about whether it's just a different way of looking at things. But has it been slow because of our cognitive emotional apparatus? And I think an argument people have made in this respect is that objectivity, in the sense of thinking that everybody's pains and pleasures count equally, is a very abstract thought, and it's not one that could have developed in our hunter-gatherer ancestors or our primate ancestors. What they developed was some impulse control, reduction of aggression, less overt emotionality than the primates have. So we do have much more capacity to step back, think, restrain ourselves than our primate ancestors did. Probably not our hunter-gatherer ancestors. There's no reason to think that our minds, as we come out of the womb, are any different from theirs. But as Mill and, of course, the whole tradition of moral philosophy have stressed, you need more than whatever natural capacity for detachment you were born with. Moral theory stresses this impersonal, abstract, standing back point of view. And many of the great religions of the world emphasize not only compassion, but also detachment. And that is really crucial to morality and to the possibility of moral progress, being able to take yourself out of the situation, which is also a psychological feature that we do possess. Adam Smith reminded us that we do feel as though we are observed in our actions. We ask ourselves, well, if I were not involved in this, how would I judge myself? Or how would I be judging the other person in this situation? So we need to cultivate that. Now, philosophers like Bernard Williams very eloquently and very movingly argue that there are limits to what we can do. We care about our own projects. We care about the people close to us. We can never care as much about distant strangers. And if we detached ourselves completely from our personal partial concerns, we would end up like Marcus Aurelius, who, again, in a sort of moving way, says, yes, you can look down on human affairs and just see the scurryings of ants. You know, nothing really matters. So we have to be in the world. We are our partial emotional selves. And that was put into us by evolution. But we also do have this ability, which must be part of our evolved cognitive apparatus, to adopt a more general, more abstract, less emotional and more impartial perspective.
Thanks very much, Catherine. I'd like to invite responses from the panel now. Anna?
I would just like to focus on one thing that Catherine said that I think is extremely important. She said one way in which moral progress can come about is if some parties whose interests are being discounted or disregarded can somehow make their grievances felt. And this can destabilize the current arrangements, and it may lead to a new equilibrium in which those interests are better taken into account. And this is a fairly common theme. It's an important one. I think it appears in the work of philosopher Peter Railton and also Philip Kitcher more recently in his book, The Ethical Project. And I think it's very important for understanding some forms of progress that have already occurred. But here's a kind of puzzle. There are some other forms of moral progress that have occurred that don't fit that model at all. And what I have in mind in particular is better treatment of non-human animals. Okay. Non-human animals can't strap suicide vests on or storm the Bastille and say, you've been disregarding our interests, shake things up, and force us to create a new order that treats them better. Instead, somehow, human beings who had this rather nasty evolved morality, this tribalistic morality that supposedly arose in the earlier environment, have gotten to the point where they can actually take a concern for the interest of beings who can't affect them one way or the other, can't benefit them, can't harm them, are not part of their cooperative group. And I think this is really striking, and it tells us something about the limitations of the evolutionary story about morality, because according to at least the simple version of the evolutionary story, it's completely anomalous that human beings should come to have these attitudes toward non-human animals.
Jason? All right, thanks. So I wanted to pick up on a different point that Catherine mentioned concerning objectivity, but I think this is a very important one. When people worry about whether evolution has undermined the objectivity of morality, they often wonder whether evolution suggests that morality is really reduced to anything goes in terms of a kind of social practice. But I think it's important to realize that objectivity and relativism are not actually antonyms. Right? They are actually they're orthogonal, they're perpendicular concepts. The opposite of objective is subjective. The opposite of relative is absolute or universal. And so when we think about morality, there's actually a fourfold classification of possibilities. Traditional religious groundings of morality are both universal and objective. The worry that many people have are subjective relative conceptions of morality. That's the anything goes. However, if morality is relative to a historical development, but yet is something which is a group phenomenon, it can be both objective and relative. Think of conventions like what side of the road you drive on. In some countries, you drive on the right. In some countries, you drive on the left. It is an objective fact in those countries what the right thing to do is. You can't change that by changing your mind. Yet it's relative to the historical development. Moral facts exist on top of the physical world in this way, like social conventions, right? And so I think it's important to realize that objectivity and morality is compatible with a great deal of cultural variation, what people think is the right thing to do. And this raises, then, just as a lead to the next topic on progress, if you think that morality can be both objective and relative, that makes this whole question of what actually do we mean by progress very difficult to understand.
Excellent.
Good, thanks. Well, first, yes, this speaking on behalf of the inarticulate is a very important part of moral progress if we look at it historically. The way in which people in the 17th century treated their animals was absolutely shocking. And even though they didn't have factory farming and all the horrors that we know about now, they were pretty brutal. So what happened? Well, people identified with the animals. And this is something that is part of our cognitive apparatus, the ability to understand what another entity, even if it's not a human entity, is feeling and experiencing and to care about it. And moral progress on behalf of laborers who couldn't speak out for themselves, to help them get organized and get labor legislation passed, on behalf of women who knew something was wrong with their lives in the 1950s but needed someone to help them articulate what was wrong. These are very important tasks for activists to take on. And now we see the same sort of thing happening in relation to financial inequality and misdoing. We need somebody to collate the facts and get people angry so that they make the kinds of demands that will bring about change.
Okay, now, as before, I'd like to take some questions from the audience again on this particular topic. Let's start, so four rows back, the woman towards the edge of the row, and then we'll go to the very back row. And then we'll go across to the other side.
Okay. Yeah, so my question basically is that concerning the scientific progress of society, if scientists throughout history or throughout the ages didn't ignore certain moral or ethical behavior, we wouldn't have certain medicine, we wouldn't have any progress that we see today, we wouldn't have any advances in the scientific community, or even in, I guess, in how industrialized and developed we've become. Where do they fit in this objectivity, would you say?
Great, thanks. And then a question from the very back row.
Hi, my question is about what happens when you shift the understanding of ethics from a religious framework through to an objective scientific framework, and if and whether that project naturally leads to the undermining of morality as a whole, not only because we lose the authority and the motivating framework that causes us to act morally, the carrot and the stick, but also because, as has been said, there's this kind of, with the evolutionary perspective, you're looking at things that might have adapted for much earlier times, which then brings into question about whether those traits are valuable in the current day. So my question is, as we shift from the religious to the secular, do we lose the motivating underpinnings of morality?
Thanks. And then the final question from the very edge of the top row on the other side. Please wait for the microphone to come to you, even though it may take a few seconds. And thanks for to everyone for participating in the train to move the microphone across the room.
Thank you. I subscribe to two philosophical views, theories, moral nihilism and psychological egoism, which is to say the notion that morality does not exist objectively. And the only laws that truly apply are natural laws, the laws of gravity and whatever else, and that within the laws of physics, anything is permissible, ultimately. And as far as the psychological egoism is concerned, it's the notion that the one thing that governs all human behavior, whether you're politically left or politically right or Christian or Muslim or atheist, it's self-interest, which is to say that as far as one can perceive benefit to themselves according to their own notion of what is good or bad based upon their education, their upbringing, that would ultimately determine what they do. And so I wonder what your responses are to these two philosophical notions.
Thanks very much. So three really interesting questions there. I mean, this issue of whether scientific progress in some sense relies on violating moral norms this question of whether something is inevitably lost when we take morality out of a religious setting and move it into a secular scientific one, and this issue of concepts of nihilism, whether evolution rules out the possibility of moral laws as opposed to natural laws, and whether it means in the end morality relies on some kind of egoism. I'll invite Catherine to start us on this.
Okay. Science had to hurt a lot of animals to get the drugs that we use today, and probably other things that we use today. And I think we have to see this as part of the tragedy of history, to produce palaces, arts, the beautiful textiles of ancient Japan, the carpets of Turkey, right? Children have been oppressed. People have been subject to horrendous working conditions. It's been awful. The cost of producing civilization and everything we enjoy in human terms has been terrible. And what moral progress is about is trying to, now that we understand that, understand how we can have what we value in civilization with less human cost. And I think we are learning how to learn. So that's my answer to the first question. Second one, this shift from theology, do we lose our motivations? I imagine some people might if they have grown up thinking that the reason to do things is that God will punish you and you will go to hell if you ever tell a lie, and then they decide, oh, that's not true. Maybe they might start telling more lies. I don't know if that would be how it works. Many people without a theological framework, maybe they still retain something of the idea that morality is opposed to their interests and that they must act in accord with it no matter what. But people still manage to have moral concerns, sacrifice their own interests, take moral stands, even without having any theological beliefs at all. Third question about nihilism and egoism. Well, I think one of the things that, as Jason has told us, that evolutionary theory has stressed is that people are a bundle of motives, not only self-seeking, self-aggrandizing motives that act in my own interests, whatever happens to anybody else, but self-sacrificing interests. Tubi and Cosmides have pointed out in a very interesting article that we do not expect reciprocity in many of our actions. We shower benefits on people who are never going to benefit us back. And they give very interesting account of how that sort of behavior could have evolved. But it's a fact that we just are motivated in conflicting ways, and there's no sort of bottom line in which everything is egoistically motivated. That's just not how human social life and psychology work.
I can't add much to what Catherine said. I think she gave terrific answers to all three questions. But I'd just like to come back to the question that the woman at the back of the room had about what happens when people lose religious belief and take on more generally a scientific outlook. Well, I'll put this in a very provocative way, but it's just one response that people have given to your question, and that is, they would say, look, if your previous view of morality was a kind of divine command theory, then you really didn't have a conception of morality, because simply doing something because you think that some extremely powerful being wants you to and has told you to is not actually acting for moral reasons at all. And that it's only when you get beyond a kind of divine command theory that you can come to appreciate the normativity of ethics. That is, the fact that there's something about reason-giving in the ethical process, and that we can have better reasons or worse reasons for different kinds of behavior. And as he rightly pointed out, there's a kind of path dependency, right? If you think of morality as being something developed socially, then under certain kinds of circumstances, certain moral norms will develop, and they may be quite appropriate in those circumstances. In other circumstances, you'll get another path of development. It'd be surprising if there wasn't some overlap, given that we're all human beings and that all societies face some common problems. But once you begin to think of it this way, then I think you can realize that if reason-giving has something at all important to do with morality, then there's a sense in which you can explain the normativity of morality, that is, the oughtness, you might put it that way, without recourse to the idea of divine command.
Jason.
So, if I might turn to the question about what happens when we move away from religious foundations of moral belief. One of the things which I think is really quite fascinating, liberating, and also terrifying about what the existentialists suggested, when we accept that there is this fantastic notion of human freedom that we face, that aside from, as someone mentioned, the physical constraints of that reality imposes, there's a great deal of freedom we have in terms of setting our social life on top of that. The thing we need to realize is once we move to a conception of morality that's not grounded in religion, we are forced to confront the question of what do we value? What kinds of people do we want to be? What do we think is the right thing to do? And we need to be able to justify that and defend that and to say why we think that. And that's very important because the kinds of people we might want to become might fall outside the scope of what would have been viewed as permissible given religious beliefs or religious constraints that were written in a time long ago that's different from the society in which we now inhabit. Regarding the question that the person asked in the back, I think the conflict between egoism and morality is interesting, but I think the important thing to keep in mind is this. Society requires that we find solutions for the interpersonal conflicts that are generated when you try to maximize what you want, I try to maximize satisfaction of what I want, as well as everyone else in this room trying to do the same thing. Morality provides a kind of toolkit for trying to negotiate those conflicts, I think, in a way so that each of us are able to get what we want to the greatest extent possible, given the constraints placed by other people. So, although I think you're right that, in a strict sense, nothing is prohibited aside from what is physically impossible, in order to have a functioning society that doesn't just fall apart into chaos and anarchy, there do need to be some solutions to the problems that society faces. There's a certain amount of latitude to that, as Alan was suggesting, but I think there's also a certain core of perhaps not the actual solutions that society settles upon, but upon the kinds of solutions that it finds. Property rights, kinship rights, what you consider to be respectful treatment of others, and so on. There's a lot of difference in that, but it all, I think, goes towards establishing social cohesion in a well-functioning of society.
So turning now then from the past, in a sense, to the future, I'd like to invite Alan Buchanan to introduce our third topic, which is, if morality is an evolved adaptation, does that limit the potential for moral progress in the future?
Let me explain why someone might think that that's so. It's because they have a simple story about the evolution of morality, of our moral capacities and moral responses. And here's the way the story goes in the simplest form. The idea is that in the Pleistocene era, roughly between 100,000, a little over a million years ago, that was the environment in which our moral capacities came to exist in response to selective pressures of the conditions of that environment. Now, what was that environment like? Well, there were small groups of human beings, widely scattered. They had very low levels of productivity, so that sharing resources with other groups would be prohibitively costly. They were vulnerable to infections from other groups because they were widely scattered, and each population would be something like a virgin population compared to the other, something like the way the Aboriginal people of the New World were with respect to European infectious diseases. And there were no significant social practices or institutions that enabled peaceful, mutually beneficial cooperation between groups. Anyone here watch the Walking Dead series? Okay, this is the environment of evolutionary adaptation is basically the environment of the post-zombie apocalypse, where everything's broken down and there are these scattered groups of survivors. I think this is a wonderful series for teaching evolutionary theory about morality. It's another matter. Okay. Now, you can imagine that if that's the environment in which our basic moral capacities and responses developed, you would expect those capacities and responses to be some people would say tribalistic, very exclusionary. There would be thick moral relations within the group, but people in this group would generally regard strangers, people in other groups, with fear or hostility, and they might not even grant them any moral status at all. So that's the picture. Now, if that's the picture of the way in which our moral capacities and responses developed, then you can see why people who buy that picture would have doubts about moral progress, at least moral progress in one important dimension, inclusivity, that is, coming to view all human beings as having a certain basic moral status, certain basic human rights. A cosmopolitan outlook is another way of putting it. Instead, you would expect people to have this sort of thick in-group morality, but moral disregard for people outside the group. So it's because of their acceptance of this picture of the origins of morality in the environment of evolutionary adaptation that some people draw these pessimistic conclusions about what we're now capable of. I call these people evo-conservatives. That is, they have a very pessimistic view about the possibilities for moral progress. I'll give you one example. There's a book called The Limits of International Law by Jack Goldsmith and Eric Posner. And at one point they say, well, you know, there's all these people saying we need more cosmopolitan international institutions, institutions which really take the well-being of all people of the world seriously. Don't bet on it. That's wishful thinking. We're not beings that were designed for that kind of concern for strangers. Instead, we have very limited moral concern. We have limited altruism. And it's just a pipe dream to think that it could ever be extended enough to support genuinely cosmopolitan institutions. So those are the evo-conservatives. Now there's another group that comes on the scene more recently that I call evo-liberals, and this includes my good friend Julian Sebelescu and Ingmar Persson at the Uhiro Center at Oxford. And they accept the grim story about our tribalistic morality, but they have a completely different reaction. Instead of saying, well, don't expect too much, they say, we've got to rewire ourselves by using biomedical interventions. That is, we need, if we're evolved to have these limited capacities, then we need to use science, perhaps even genetic engineering of human embryos, to change ourselves so that we're capable of extended altruism. We're capable of more inclusive moral responses. Okay. Now, I have a third view, which is different from both of these, and it's shared with my co-author on a lot of work on moral progress, Russell Powell, who's a philosopher of biology person. And our view is that there's a common mistake of the evo-conservatives, the pessimist, and the wild-eyed biomedical interventionist, if I might call them that, the evo-liberals, not to put too prejudicial characterization on them. And that is, they both accept this simple story of the origins of human morality and then make the mistake of saying that because that's the way morality originally was, that's the way it is now, and that's the way it's going to be in the future. And I think the interesting thing is that even though human beings started out apparently with a rather limited, exclusionary, tribalistic morality, somehow, at least under certain favorable conditions, they've developed something that goes quite beyond that. As it were, they've stretched the evolutionary leash. And I don't think we can predict now how much further we can stretch it. I think it's already been stretched to a remarkable degree. As Catherine pointed out, in the 16th century, if you looked at a good English cookbook, it would tell you how to prepare a goose. Before you kill it, you should beat it for hours on end, because it'll taste better when you cook it. In Paris, a wholesome family recreation was watching public cat burnings. Cruel punishments of human beings were the order of the day throughout most of the world until very recently. It's only really been roughly since the 18th century that you begin to get rejection of extremely cruel punishments, some better treatment of animals, and some beginnings of the feminist movement. And you get in Britain, and this is one of the great triumphs of British culture, you get the British abolitionist movement of the late 18th century. Okay. So something has happened, okay? Even if you accept this simple story, it turns out that our moral capacities have developed in ways that you wouldn't have been able to predict just on the basis of that environment. And I think there are material factors. That is, I think that in general, societies have to get to a point of relative abundance compared to the grim, scarce resources of the early environment. And you need to get communication techniques so that ideas about how we ought to change things morally can change. You need to get mass literacy, for example, printing presses. And under these conditions, you can get cultural innovations which enable us to transcend to some extent the narrow limitations of this tribalistic morality. And actually, I think Catherine mentioned one earlier, and that is there's a kind of moral technology that's called the Golden Rule or other perspective-taking techniques, right? And these are things that have been developed. They're not innate ideas. They've been developed. And when people utilize them, it helps them, again, under favorable conditions, to be able to transcend this kind of narrow tribalistic morality. Now, here's the bad news. Some of the same general techniques for building bridges outward for increasing inclusivity can be perverted and subverted and used to dismantle those bridges and to bring people back toward a more tribalistic morality. This is exactly what occurs when there's propaganda for genocides, for example. The people who gear other people up for genocides try to convince them that, in effect, they are in something like the environment of evolutionary adaptation. That is, that the other group is a threat to their survival, that there's no possibility of peaceful, mutually beneficial cooperation with them. And often it's even said that they're bearing horrible diseases. They're like, they're subject to infecting us with bad health conditions. So the good news is that the more we can lift ourselves out of these harsh conditions of the environment of evolutionary adaptation, the more space is created for the possibility of cultural innovations which can extend the evolutionary leash and move us toward more inclusive moral responses. The bad news is there's nothing inevitable about this happening, and there can be regression. Thank you.
Thanks. Catherine?
Yeah. That raised for me the very interesting question of charismatic leaders and warfare. All the anthropological writers that I've read mostly stress that within the group, people are very unhierarchical. They don't like being bossed around. They ridicule or drive out or assassinate people who get too dominant and bossy. Yet we see in civilization, and as soon as groups reach a certain size, that people follow insane charismatic leaders, people who are absolutely psychotic. How do we explain, do you think, this transition in what seems like a very basic kind of response? And that's why we have wars, for the most part.
Well, yeah, I mean, the sort of standard story is that in the environment of evolutionary adaptation, you did have this non-hierarchical organization, although I think it's a bit rosy to say that relations between men and women were not hierarchical, but certainly there wasn't this sort of idea of an elite ruler or ruling class that had tremendous authority over others, and there was all sorts of efforts to prevent that from happening. Okay, but then, with the Neolithic Revolution, the story goes, that is when people developed domestication of animals and agriculture, you got much larger numbers of human beings living together year-round in the same location, orders of magnitude larger populations. You got a division of labor, and you got an increase of warfare between groups because now there were social surpluses which a group could capture if they invaded and took over another group. And then the idea is that somehow these different conditions created a tendency for people to concentrate power in a small number of people, or in some cases, one individual. Now, I think a lot needs to be filled out for this kind of story, but I think it must be that this transition from relatively non-hierarchical to extremely hierarchical societies that occurred with the Neolithic Revolution, it must have something to do with the complexity and scale of the societies. Now, you might say that part of what the story of moral progress is our being able to exist in increasingly complex social environments with larger population densities, but gradually pulling back from the hierarchical forms that were characteristic of the first human responses to complexity in large populations. And one way you might put this is to use the terminology of a wonderful book called Plagues and People by Neely. And that is, he says that macroparasitism may be on the wane. Macroparasitism is some human beings acting as parasites on others through these hierarchical forms. And you might think of things like the development of the rule of law, the development of limited constitutional government, the development of democracy as attempts to have our cake and eat it too, to have the benefits of large-scale societies with complex division of labor, but without this toxic hierarchy that Catherine referred to. So that might be one dimension to moral progress. But we also know that there can be regression, that when things don't go well in a society, sometimes these charismatic leaders arise and they gain a lot of traction and they turn the clock back so far as this one dimension to moral progress goes, getting away from hierarchy but still being able to preserve the benefits of highly complex societies with large numbers of people.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, how long do we have? Because when you presented this picture on which moral progress can happen, but it doesn't always happen particularly quickly. And I take part of the Savulescu-style evo-liberal pessimism to stem from this worry that we've maybe got about 100 years with society as it is now, motivating this drive to do everything we can, including genetic engineering if necessary.
Good. This is Stephen Hawking's view, too. He thinks we have very little time left. And that's what really gives some plausibility to the Savulescu and Persson view that we need to intervene biomedically. The idea is that cultural change just may be too slow. Well, it may be too slow, but it's difficult for me to imagine how we could have sort of a large-scale biomedical intervention program that would change humanity sufficiently to deal with these problems. I mean, quite apart from the fact that there's no chance we'll have the social discipline to do it, right? I mean, when it comes to being unruly, human beings are especially unruly with respect to reproduction, right? So I don't expect sort of everybody, including ISIS members, lining up for their biomedical interventions. And also, I think that we know so little about the biological bases of particular moral responses that this is extremely wishful thinking at this point. I mean, for example, the example people often give for how you can biomedically enhance people morally is oxytocin. Okay, oxytocin is a brain hormone, and it turns out that if you spray a little oxytocin at people's nostrils, they'll generally do better in cooperative games because they'll evidence more trust. Okay, well, here's a problem. Aside from the problem of sort of equipping everybody on planet Earth with oxytocin inhalers. In addition to that, the problem with oxytocin-inspired trust is that it's completely promiscuous. That is, you just happen to exhibit higher levels of trust to whoever happens to be in your immediate environment, right? And that's not a good thing.
Jason?
So I think the example about oxytocin-based trust is a nice illustration of why you don't always want academics to be designing public policy. What I think is interesting here about the question about moral progress is that Ellen started talking about the environment of evolutionary adaptation. Now, it's important to keep in mind that what was being selected for there was largely behaviors, right? What people or groups did. But the important aspect about morality is really the theoretical angle, how we describe what it is that we're doing, what principles we endorse that actually we take ourselves to be following. And the thing that's interesting about that is that the moral principles we would want to endorse are in many senses underdetermined by behavior. There are many moral principles that we can kind of map on to what we do any single time. And moreover, when we actually write down a moral principle, there's a question about how do we understand that? How do we interpret it? And I think this is where progress can be made. So think about the group example. You might imagine that evolution selects for a simple principle, right? Help us rather than them. Then the question is, who is the us? How do we construct the group? How do we identify a particular group? One of the things that's interesting about Singer's notion of the expanding circle is that the scope of what we take to be morally relevant beings the us to be protected, is actually capable of being influenced and shaped by our own thinking and by our own deliberation of what we take to be important. So this principle, help us, not them, is not restrictive, because those categories of we versus and the other are flexible. And about the I think the very good point that certain moral principles are not only capable of facilitating progress but also regress, I mean, realize that that even applies to such a simple moral principle as the golden rule.
Yes.
Right? You take the principle, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Ask yourself, how could that possibly go wrong? Realize that there's a hidden assumption, namely, don't be a jerk. Right? I mean, if you're happy with being a jerk, doing unto others as you would have them do unto you would generate a really regressive moral development. So,
could I just add one thing about the Golden Rule? There's a marvelous book called The Nazi Conscience by Claudia Kunst, a historian, a colleague of mine at Duke. And she excerpts a passage from an instruction manual for public school teachers in the Third Reich, in the Nazi era, okay? And it says something like this: well, you're not supposed to just teach your students information, you also teach them values. And one of the most important is the Golden Rule. Of course, with the proviso that it applies only to racial comrades. So here you have this moral technology, the Golden Rule, which, as we understand it, enables you to sort of take everybody into account, aside from the problem that Jason pointed out, which is a serious problem, okay? But what the Nazis have done is to restrict the scope of the rule by saying it only applies to Aryans. It doesn't apply to non-Aryans, Jews, Slavs, etc., okay? So this is a great example of how there's a cultural innovation that develops a kind of technique for moral thinking, but it can become subverted and perverted by changing the characterization of who is us, of who it applies to.
Great, so I'd now like to invite questions from the audience on this topic. Let's start at the very end of the front row here, and then we'll go back to the second row.
You talked about the Third Reich, the Nazis. How does the evolution of moral progression explain that, A, and B, can it happen again? What the panel think?
Okay, and then there was a question from directly behind.
I think when we're talking about the evolution or progress in morality, it means we should have in mind an end for it. It's a dynamic movement, obviously, when we're talking about progress. Progress towards where? What? So it means we should imagine an end. Otherwise, talking about evolution, because evolution implies moving towards something, completing itself. Don't you think that talking about a progress would necessarily bring another point element like teleological approach to morality? There should be an end for it.
Okay, and then a third question from the front row here, and then we should be able to fit in a couple more.
This gets kind of nitty-gritty, but we have hundreds of thousands of people living in refugee camps with nothing. And we have an expanding group of people in London digging sub-basements, making their neighbors' lives hell. You know, the buy-to-let, the woman upstairs from me is redoing her flat. I have to be out of my flat every day, regardless, because the noise bothers me. Where is this going? How is this evolutionary, and where is the morality in sort of, if you have, you can do whatever. If you don't have, well, screw you.
Okay, thanks. And a question from the very end of the fifth row there. We'll just have one more after that. Thanks.
I was just going to ask, kind of going back to what you said about going from a tribal perspective, so thinking about like Dunbar's number, where we can only know between 50 and 250 people, it seems like we've evolved culturally far faster than we have biologically. I was just going to ask how viable you thought using things like AI and virtual reality and things like that as a way to kind of jumpstart our biological morality that we possess and kind of bring up to speed with the cultural morality.
Great, and then finally just a question from the end of the third row here. Going back across the room again, I'm afraid. And then I'll invite responses from the panel to all of those perspectives.
Thank you. So my question is twofold. The first one is that, it has been assumed that there is teleological progress, or is it so? Or assuming that the progress we're talking about is teleological, and does this mean that there will be some convergence, and doesn't this create the danger of some kind of imperialism of Western morality over other moralities? And this relates to my second point, which is, can we not say that what has been said to be moral progress in reality is political progress and not moral progress?
Great, thanks. So a very interesting range of perspectives there. I mean, some of them quite sceptical of this notion of moral progress. I mean, questions about how to get from A to B, about what the end of it is, if it's aiming at an end at all. A question of how can we really say there's moral progress when we look at the grotesque inequality and appalling treatment of refugees and so on. But also more optimistic perspectives about whether the onset of AI could aid in some way in the moral enhancement of humanity. Alan, would you like to start us?
Well, on the virtual reality AI, I think that, in fact, communication techniques have played a big role in some cases of moral progress. Again, abolitionism is a good example. The abolitionists sent people under false pretenses to go on the ships that were carrying slaves in the Middle Passage, and they covertly drew pictures of the slaves packed into the holds. They came back to Britain. These were mass-produced. Now we have television. Sometimes people can be moved to political action by vivid graphic images of other people suffering, so I think that is important. Now, on this question about, you know, why the Nazis, I mean, there are whole libraries of literature are trying to explain them. But I think, again, that part of the explanation lies in thinking about what are the conditions under which an exclusionary tribalistic morality are likely to flourish, because that's what Nazi morality was like. It was a morality. The Nazis had a morality. It was a very demanding morality, but it was strictly an intra-group kind of morality. And we have to think about what the material conditions are, the economic conditions. We have to think about what kinds of techniques the mobilizers of mass violence and discrimination have used. And I think quite a lot is known about this. And one of the standard tropes that you hear in the Holocaust literature, in the literature about the Third Reich generally, is the idea of propaganda that is dehumanizing. Okay. Now, in some ways, the fact that they had to dehumanize people in order to get people to kill them shows that there's been progress, right? Because the idea is that if you're a human, then you have certain basic rights and certain things we can't rightly do to you. So the very fact that the Nazis had to dehumanize their victims is a kind of backhanded compliment to the fact that we've already transcended the very limited tribalistic morality that might have been characteristics of our ancestors. But we know something about the techniques that people use to achieve this dehumanization and to sort of dismantle these cultural innovations like the Golden Rule that extended our moral regard for others. And we know something about the material and economic and political conditions under which these authoritarian, charismatic leaders arise. So I think...
It's very easy.
Yeah, and I look, one big difference between the way I think we should think about moral progress now and the way people thought about it from the Enlightenment through the 19th century is we shouldn't think it's secure and we shouldn't think it's inevitable. Earlier theories of moral progress tended to think that it was always moving forward, there was no going back in any significant way, and that there were iron laws of progress. I think that's all just bunk. I think moral progress is very fragile and unusual, and there are things we can do to increase the probability of it occurring, but it's not a sure thing. We should always keep that in mind.
Can I just jump in on this point about moral progress? Let me begin with a very brief anecdote about the Roman Empire. So if you think about the technology that the Romans had, which was then lost after its collapse, the Romans had running water, they had indoor plumbing, they had under-the-floor heating, right? After the Roman Empire collapsed, it was hundreds of years before that technology, you know, was reinvented. Why do I mention that? Morality is social technology. It is a way of thinking that actually helps us navigate the complexities of social life and to yield outcomes which are mutually beneficial. And social technology, like any technology, can be lost under certain conditions. And so the threat is very real that the progress we've seen recently can or could be lost under certain conditions. Just a point about the question about housing, if I may. you raised the example about by to let the people in migrant camps and all of this, all of these odd asymmetries. Part of what to keep in mind is the fact that what is legal and what is moral are not coextensive. They don't overlap. They partially overlap. But I think what's interesting here is a change in the public conception of morality in the years post-Thatcher, which is that we see an erosion of the value of public goods. We see an erosion in the value of just things which are to be shared goods. We've seen under kind of contemporary economic ideology, personal interest and personal gain at the expense of things for the public. Perhaps that shift in morality is part of what drives this phenomena that you observe.
Presumably not progress.
Not progress, but a shift in morality.
Yeah, so if I could just return to this theme of macro-parasitism. This is really an important evolutionary concept in Dawkins' The Extended Phenotype. He has several chapters on parasitism as just a ubiquitous strategy in the natural world. Everything is looking for a niche where it can do better. And it seems that we are becoming aware of the ways in which this functions on a macro level, with not only people but groups looking for advantage, looking for weaknesses, looking for vulnerabilities. And one of the benefits of thinking in biological terms is that you see how these patterns appear, not because slavery isn't natural to humans, but it's an exploitative pattern that exists in nature and that can realize itself in the social realm. So what I want to make a plug for is the importance of a humanistic and scientific education as supporting moral progress. If we lose either one, we could go backwards. In case of the Nazis, people sometimes say, how could these cultured people with their music and their opera and their literature, how could they have become persuaded by Hitler? But the educational system was changing rapidly at the end of the 19th century. The emphasis was on not teaching humanity subjects, teaching militarily important technological subjects. And when we see diversion of resources into military research and into purely technological kinds of instruction, then I begin to worry.
Yes, great. Yeah, and just in wrapping up this discussion, I mean, I'd like to focus on that more optimistic thread in what we've had up to now. You know, assuming moral progress is indeed possible and that it doesn't have to take the form of genetic engineering of human embryos, but can be achieved by other means. How exactly is it to be achieved? And Catherine's made some remarks on that, commenting on the importance of humanistic scientific education. I'd just like all the panelists to make some quick comments on that question about how we are to go about achieving moral progress in the future. And we'll start with Alan.
Just a simple idea. I think we need to look at the best examples of moral progress that have already occurred and see what we can learn about how that occurred. And I think we have the great benefit of having a lot of information about perhaps the greatest single instance of moral progress, British abolitionism. We have a tremendous amount of information about how the abolitionists operated, about how they put pressure on the British government to end slavery in the British Empire at a time when slavery was vital to the economy, vital to the empire. And this was because of a certain, what you might call, social epistemological conditions in Britain that were different from other countries where there was also slaveholding. There's a wonderful book by Seymour Drescher called Slavery and Emancipation, where he argues that the big difference in Britain was that there was a robust civil society. There was freedom of expression. There was freedom of assembly and association. There was mass literacy. And there was a kind of Protestant Christianity, almost exclusively nonconformists, that is not Anglican, which came to reinterpret Christianity as being incompatible with slavery. And then, because of these civil society conditions, it was possible for people to mobilize and to exert pressure on the government at a time when, for the first time, the government was taking public opinion seriously. So I think there's a lot to be learned. We can look at the movement for better treatment of animals. We can look at the feminist movement. We can look at the abolitionist movement. And we can try to understand what you might call the norm entrepreneurship that occurred. That is, that new norms somehow develop, and there are some people who devote themselves to spreading the acceptance of those norms, and some things they do work, and some things they do not work.
Jason? So, in terms of the brief answer to the question of how is moral progress possible, I would just say the most important thing to keep in mind is that we're all fallible. Never assume that the beliefs you have about what is the right thing to do are actually correct. Treat all of your moral beliefs as potentially revisable. And in the moments when you have time for philosophical reflection, always be willing to entertain the question of why is it that I actually believe that?
Catherine?
I think I said what I...
You're totally in agreement.
To say. Yeah, yeah.
Could I just add one comment to what he said? The idea of moral progress has been horribly abused and misused. Okay? In fact, it was so misused in the case of the ideology of colonialism that many people now say we shouldn't even talk about moral progress. Right? I think that's going too far, but I agree completely. We have to be very careful about assuming that we know what moral progress is, and we also have to think very hard about what the appropriate means for trying to further moral progress are.
Okay, and on that cautiously optimistic note, that's all we have time for. Thank you all very much for coming and for contributing, and let's thank our panelists for a very interesting discussion.